Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to the Politics Guys with your hosts, Jay Parson and Michael Baranowski.
Hello, and welcome to the Politics Guys, a weekly roundup of what's been happening in American politics and why it matters. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My co-host this week is, as always, Cleveland attorney and sometime Republican strategist Jay Carson, the man to see for all your commercial litigation needs. In this week's episode, Jay and I discuss the open letter 47 Senate Republicans sent to Iran, supposedly to educate them as to how the American political system works. Jay argues it may have been secretly brilliant, while I say it was not so secretly moronic and might backfire on them. Hillary Clinton, who grudgingly faced the media last week to answer questions about her use of private email for government business when she was Secretary of State. Will this matter in 2016? Jay says yes. I say, get real. The big week in Ferguson, Missouri, which saw the resignation of their municipal judge, city manager, police chief, and the shooting of two Ferguson police officers. Climate change. Is it a belief system or a scientific fact? And finally, what's it going to take for Secret Service agents to stop getting drunk, hiring hookers, and letting nuts with knives run into the White House? Our lead story this week is the letter that 47 Republican senators sent to Iran, warning them against making an agreement with President Obama.
Can't trust this guy, Mike.
You know, what did you think about that, Jay?
Well, I think the bigger story is the reaction that it engendered on the left, and I was of two minds when it first happened. I'm going to hit both these points. One is this something illegal, improper, wrongful, treasonous, as the New York Daily News said. And then also was it a good idea? And I'll tell you, I've come around. Originally, my thought was, it's probably not a legal violation, but it was probably a dumb idea. But the more I've thought about that, it may be secretly brilliant.
Secretly brilliant.
And hopefully intentionally so, but you just never know. The internet's the interwebs erupted with calls of how inappropriate this is, that Congress members direct a letter to foreign government. Now, of course, it was an open letter.
And so let's just say, I want to go on record as saying open letters are, as a general rule, moronic. And this one, I don't think, is any different. When I see the words open letter, I roll my eyes. I rolled my eyes no less at this ridiculous, moronic open letter, which, in fact, actually got the legislative process a little bit wrong, actually, or the foreign policy process.
Well, we can talk about that. But I would say, first, by definition, an open letter is not really meant for the person it's addressed to. It's to wind up everybody else.
I think it's a lazy way of getting publicity for an issue.
Well, lazy or good might be another way to put it. First of all, going to the legality of this, there were folks who were screaming about the Logan Act. And in many cases, they got the Logan Act wrong. Logan Act was an act that was passed in 1799, signed by President John Adams. And this goes back to, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, the quasi-war that America was fighting with France in the late 1790s. And what happened was, there was a guy, George Logan. He was a state senator from Pennsylvania. A lot of the papers have reported that he was actually a sitting U.S. senator, but he was actually a state senator, which in those days was in many cases a much bigger deal. And he took a trip to France and met with your favorite old French diplomat, Talleyrand.
Yeah.
And negotiated, essentially, for the release of some prisoners that are being held. And he offered his advice to the French about, look, how you could do a better job at PR and prevent a potential war or more hostilities with the Americans. He wasn't actually prosecuted, but this act was put in place that prevents people from conducting essentially their own personal foreign policy.
Yeah, and just to break in here, to be clear, what this letter said is that essentially that the Iranians might not understand how our system of government works, and even if they reached an agreement with President Obama, that agreement could be abrogated by the next president because it would just be an executive agreement. It wouldn't have the...
It's not a treaty.
It's yeah. not a treaty, right.
The response, I think, is one, the Logan Act is... only been used one time in history where someone was indicted for it, and that was in 1803. And he was, although indicted, never actually prosecuted. Again, it had to do with dealings with France and sort of during the time that he would have been prosecuted. We bought Louisiana, and a lot of the issues sort of became moot. The other piece of this is the Logan Act even constitutional? And I think most people would probably say no, in that it prevents freedom of speech. Again, it's never been subject to judicial review. It came out of the same time, same spirit as the Alien and Sedition Acts. So I just would doubt that anything would ever happen. But every once in a while, people bring it up. When someone who's not the president starts communicating with foreign leaders in one way or another.
So let's get to the politics of this. What do you think that the Republicans were trying to do with this letter? Let's assume that their ostensible purpose to educate Iran on how our system of government works was not at all the purpose. That would be ridiculous.
But, I agree. That would be ridiculous.
So what do you think they were? What do you think they're trying to do with this?
I think what they're trying to do is, and what they succeeded in is putting this issue of the Iran deal, what's in it, how is it going to work, front and center. You could have done the same thing, and people have noted this that you could have just written an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal or something like that. I'll tell you, there was a really good op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by John McCain last week about defense funding. And I would ask, look, has anybody heard about that? Well, no, of course not. But you do something like this, and it's a political stunt, but it gets what they're after, and that is draws attention, makes it fun front page news.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, you first.
I say I really liked the response from Iran on this, where they said that it seemed that the senators didn't really understand the American system of government, where the president actually conducts foreign policy. I rarely find myself siding with Iran.
With the mullahs.
Yes, on this one odd occasion, I do actually, but anyway, go ahead.
We can talk further about is this actually conducting foreign policy? But what the second thing the letter did was it sort of made Obama show his hand publicly on this, where he says, "Look, I'm not going to Congress on this. I'm never going to Congress on this. If Congress tries to stop me, I'll veto them." And sort of this, damn it, I'm going to get a deal with Iran, no matter what. He even explained that the plan would be he gets this agreement and then he takes it to the UN Security Council.
Yeah, you know, on the veto, I think that's an important point, and this is where some commentators have argued that the Republicans might have actually, in a sense, shot themselves in the foot potentially, because before this letter, it looked like that even if there were a presidential veto on some congressional action, stopping some sort of agreement or putting in sanctions or something like further sanctions, that that Congress might have, or the Senate might actually have a veto-proof majority. And now it seems like there might be enough Democrats in the House and the Senate who are uncomfortable with what Republicans did, making it kind of a party partisan issue, that they might have lost a veto-proof majority.
Yeah, you know, I hear you, but I think my response is so what? Because I don't know that a continued sanctions, I think, are well and good, and he's going to have to get those eventually because he can't lift the sanctions by himself.
He can suspend them, I believe, but yeah, but you're right, for lifting them entirely, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what he can do by himself, and what I think he's pledging to do, is to say, look, we won't take any further action. There won't be any military action to try to stop you if you continue to enrich uranium at the levels we would allow. And there's really not much Congress could do one way or another about that. So this gets back to my point of why I think it actually works, because Iran is moving ahead regardless of the sanctions. And Iran understands that if Obama does what he says he's going to do, takes it into the UN Security Council, gets everyone else to sign on, that, look, if anyone is going to enforce this, they'll have to go through the UN, yada, yada, yada. What's going to happen is, to the extent there is a sanctions regime in place, it's going to fall apart. We might continue sanctions, but the Europeans won't. Certainly not the Chinese or the Russians or any of those folks who are usually not well disposed to us. But so that's what I mean. I think this is going to happen regardless, and it's less a matter of stopping the deal or preventing the deal or do anything with that, but making it public. That now Obama says, here's what my plan is. I'm not going to talk to the representatives you elected, but I'm going to take this to the United Nations. And I think the big GOP victory in this, and it's not going to be apparent right now, but I think it will be 9-12 months down the road, is that Obama absolutely owns this Iran deal.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely. And I think that I don't know if it's a year down the road, but again, this goes back to a disagreement we had in last week's show, that you seem to be much more in favor of the Netanyahu position, that a bad deal is worse than no deal at all. And
yes.
My view would be that an imperfect deal, that's what I'd call it, in which there's at least some inspections and some transparency that would delay Iran's effort to get nukes, is better than no deal, which would allow them to essentially just go on like they are, and I would argue get a nuclear weapon sooner than they otherwise would.
Right, right. But I think I like the idea of the Republicans laying down a marker, so to speak, saying, listen, Obama, this deal is all yours, and he is proceeding with this, and it's going to put Hillary or whoever, but let's say Hillary, in sort of a difficult position, because she's going to have to defend this.
Well, I don't know if I entirely agree with that, though she has, I don't know if she's come out with a statement on this or not. She'd be wise not to, perhaps. But I don't know that she'd have to defend it. It's clearly Obama's deal, Obama's State Department. So
well,
I don't
no,
know
I
if
mean,
this falls back
she'd
on
have
Hillary.
To, she, at some point, she'll get the question, even from the media or that we have. And maybe they link it to, isn't this because you're a woman? But, you know, is she going to continue to enforce whatever deal the president gets?
Right, right, yeah.
I mean, someone has to ask that at some point during the campaign, and she'll have to answer it at some point.
Yeah. Speaking of Hillary Clinton and answering questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's been in the news again. We talked about her a little bit last week, but on Tuesday, she met with reporters. And talking about her personal email account that she used when she was Secretary of State. And according to everyone who was there, it was an uncomfortable meeting, that she was a bit defensive, kind of lawyerly in her arguments.
Not a Clinton parsing words. You know, my favorite part of it was the first question came from someone who claimed to be affiliated with Turkish TV, because that's who you go to first.
Oh, absolutely.
In yeah. circumstances, who said, "Do you think this is all because you're a woman?"
Wow. Okay.
And you know, it seems inconceivable that the Clintons would plant a question like that a press conference. But even that, it's just sort of like, I mean, it's assuming that they did plan it. It seems so clumsy and ham-handed that it's almost not deserving of the name Clinton. I mean,
I think one interesting revelation that came out of this is she admitted that she deleted about half of her emails from this time, and there's really no way that we know of to get those back at this point, since they were, you know, in her own personal mail server.
Well, the other like interesting, and this kind of plays off what I said last week, but my surprise isn't so much that Hillary Clinton's being sneaky, it's the fact that the press is getting wound up about it. The AP is filing suit to get these various emails, and I think that's kind of surprising and welcome. Well, yeah, and another piece is that we're learning that top Hillary aides, like the former, or is she the former, or is she the current Mrs. Weiner still?
I believe, yeah.
Also had a private email system and didn't use the State Department email system, and that there may have been other top aides who chose to operate without using the government email system.
I think it brings on the media thing that you mentioned. I'm not that surprised, because the media tends to get very upset when they feel someone's keeping something from the media, even if it's one of their favorites. There was a great comment by Frank Bruni, one of the editorial or op-ed guys from the New York Times, which, of course, the New York Times will endorse Hillary Clinton against whatever Republican ends up running against her.
And sure. You know,
big fans, all of them, especially on the op-ed page. But in commenting on this, he said, you know, once again, they showed how Hillary Clinton feels aggrieved by Americans' refusal to see and simply trust how well-intentioned and virtuous and good for the country she is.
I think that sums it up, doesn't it?
I mean, in a nutshell, that, to me, that's Hillary Clinton, you know. One of the problems potentially that the Democrats have is that they've essentially put all their eggs in the Hillary basket. There's really no one running against her. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is not going to run. Joe Biden is not a serious contender. It's Hillary Clinton, period. Which is why I think a lot of Democrats have, not in the media, but a lot of, you know, Democrats in politics have defended her, because they know that this is it. It's Hillary Clinton or, I don't know, Jeb Bush, whoever the Republicans have. That, you know, that's it for them. And that's...
Well, I'm still surprised by the lack of defense that Hillary's been receiving.
See, I disagree. I think she's getting plenty of defense.
I don't think there's been that much of a defense mounted by fellow Democrats. I mean, there's been sort of, I mean, Obama, in fact, sort of threw her under the bus.
Lost between those two.
True, and I think it's the same could be said with a lot of other Democrats. Is they're reluctant to wade into this to fight another fight for the Clintons. Because let's face it, I mean, politics is in some cases, I mean, tribal. I mean, it's less parties than it is, you know, gangs and personalities and this clique versus that clique. And I think there's something to that. There are plenty of Democrats who are on the outside of the Clinton clique, and would see their futures to be less rosy for the next 4 years if she is elected.
It's more than a clique. I would say it's a dominant gang.
Criminal enterprise?
Well, I don't know if I go that far, no. But they're definitely the 800-pound gorilla here. Then no one has the networking, no one has the fundraising. I mean, they can crush anything that comes before them, and they certainly have. So this is the point, you know, this is what the political science people call the invisible campaign, the point where everyone is getting together their donor networks and so forth. And we see a lot of that on the Republican side, a lot of activity. But on the Democrat side, it's pretty much all Hillary. And so this is it, for better or worse. I think it's going to be Hillary versus, you know, whoever the Republicans can come up with.
Well, I mean, do you, as a political scientist, do you think that's the best way to choose a candidate? I can see pros and cons. I mean, we talked earlier about, look, you're not spending the money, but.
Well, yeah, that's the big pro. The unity is that you can, you know, you can really not have that divisiveness. And that's, you know, that's certainly a good thing, not have to worry about those challenges. But on the other hand, there's the argument that, you know, getting through a rough primary can teach you something. Can make you a better candidate for the general election. And, you know, I don't know that Hillary's...
Well, there's also what I would call sort of the inoculation factor, that you get the bad stuff out there and you deal with it, and the voters get a chance to hear this and sort of sort through it and maybe let it go.
I think that's the big advantage of this story coming out now for Clinton, is that... the voters aren't going to, well, they'll be reminded of it certainly, but they're not going to care that much about it. I mean, for people who've been following Hillary Clinton for decades, this is just kind of a window into her soul, at least the public, you know, demonstration of her soul.
You assume a soul where I'm reluctant to think there is one.
Well, but again, I think for most, you know, the most voters who are going to be legitimately undecided, that this is not going to resonate a whole lot. So I think it's
I differ with you there. I differ with you, because I think in a lot of cases with undecided voters and independent voters, you know, people who really claim that they're not voting a particular party line and they vote for the person and so forth, these sort of issues of personal integrity do come into play. And I think, you know, your typical independent voter is always looking for the person who's not the insider. And I think this is sort of very much insider behavior. And I think that would turn off a lot of your true independents.
Well, there aren't that many independent voters in the first place. I mean, there are people who say they're independents, but true independents, very small proportion of the electorate. Most people who are independents are lying, basically, if not to the pollsters, to themselves. So I just don't see it as making that much of a difference, really. Most everyone's mind is going to be made up, and I just don't see this as being that big of a deal.
All right. Well, we will see. I predict that this will continue to be a big deal, because the fun thing about emails, especially when there's you know, hundreds of thousands of them, is someone's going to have them. They're going to turn up somewhere. You know, there's indications that the system was already hacked at some point earlier. It's not going to go away, and she's going to have to answer for this, and there will be other email servers, or she'll have to explain why, you know, she had all, you know, I'm saying it's not going away.
Okay, well, I totally disagree. It's going away. She's not going to have to answer to it for it. It is totally not a big deal. It will have zero impact on the 2016 presidential election.
All right. Wow, you're confident again.
Yes, I am.
All right.
Okay, moving on. It's been a big week. Last week was a big week in Ferguson, Missouri. On Monday, their municipal court judge resigned, and the Missouri Supreme Court appointed a state appeals court to oversee all the municipal cases. Then on Tuesday, their city manager stepped down. On Wednesday, it was the police chief. And then Thursday, two police officers were shot in what was called an ambush during a protest. So, a lot of stuff going on in Ferguson. What do you make of all this, Jay?
Well, I think given the revelations of the federal report, the fact that the municipal judge stepped down, I think that is a good thing.
So the system's working. I mean, after the fact a little bit, but
Listen, this is, they've been called on the carpet. And, you know, my bigger concern was this over-policing, the exorbitant fines, court costs, and using the criminal justice system as a you know, not for the purposes of public safety, but the purposes of public finance. And that's something that's always troubled me. So I think that's good that he's stepped aside. You know, same goes with the other folks, given the tenor of some of the emails, racism that was in there, regardless of whether that transmitted itself into the actual policing or not. I think when you've got those kind of comments publicly being made, the top guy's got to step down. So I wasn't overly surprised, and I think that's probably steps in the right direction.
Yeah, I think it's real good to see that they're cleaning house, which definitely needed to happen. I think there's a long way to go. Unlike you, I'm a little more concerned about the racial disparities and those kind of issues, as opposed to the using the police department to collect money essentially for the city. But whatever your concerns, I think everyone can agree that having some new people in Ferguson is at least somewhat of a positive step potentially.
Right, and you know, the other piece that, and I think this is sort of a weird thing that we've got, where the Justice Department exonerated the officer, but in a sense, convicted the department. You've got a weird situation where people are out there marching still for Michael Brown. They're not really marching over overly aggressive policing or heavy court costs or that sort of thing. And I think there's sort of a disconnect. And I think that's going to come to the forefront as the year drags on, because I don't know that these protesters are going away, and I don't think that changing the judge, changing the police chief is going to satisfy them.
Well, I think what's going to make a big difference will be whatever consent agreement that they reach with the Justice Department. I mean, that can make a big difference. I know it made a difference in Cincinnati when that was done in, I think it was 2001 or 2002, after some riots that we had. So those are the kind of things, I think, that changing the culture and changing how the police do their jobs, I think that's the kind of thing that's going to make a difference. It's going to be quieter. It's going to take some time. But based on my experiences in Cincinnati, which, isn't perfect, but has a way to go, but it's gotten a lot better, I think that there's going to be a positive change over time in Ferguson.
Yeah, I'd say it can probably only get better at this point.
Yeah, it certainly the bar is set kind of low where things are, definitely. Okay, there was a article that I mentioned to you this week from the New Republic, probably not your favorite periodical.
Not my favorite, but I do read it. Yeah, and
for those of you who don't know, the New Republic is a center leftish weekly magazine, political magazine, and the article was entitled "Climate Change Isn't a Belief Like Religion; It's a Scientific Fact."
Right, and I would describe the New Republic as often wrong, but usually thoughtful. So
I say it's fair enough. I would disagree with the often wrong part, but yes, usually thoughtful is true. So what did you think about this?
Well, we'll post the article on the website so other people can read it. Yeah. And I think the argument that they're making is a fair one, but it sort of begs the question.
So?
And that is that they're saying it is a scientific fact, and the reason we don't believe in it is because it's a scientific fact, and it's because it's been scientifically proven. It's sort of circular, and well, I would respond that look, the reason science works, the reason we have scientific facts are we've got a process whereby things are tested, verified, retested, tested again. And that's how we know it's right. It's not a matter of faith that we simply believe this or not. So, I guess from a semantic point, the article is right that saying belief in global warming isn't a belief like a religious belief is, because it's based on what they say is scientific evidence. But I think you've got to say that if you're going to cite this as scientific evidence, you have to have a rigorous scientific process, and that's what I think is often lacking in the global warming world.
Well, I think I'm no scientist. I sound like a Republican here. I am no scientist, but I can certainly appreciate that when the vast majority of scientific consensus of actual real scientists suggests, number one, that climate change is a real thing that's happening, and number two, that human activity seems to be very strongly related to it. Those two things I can accept because that's what almost all of the scientists have found. Now, but past that point, I think the important question is, if you're willing to accept that, and of course a lot of Republicans aren't willing to accept that for various reasons that we'll have to get into at some other point.
Right.
The big question then is, what can we and what should we do about it? And I think this is a big enough question where it'd be an interesting topic for a very special episode of The Politics Guys.
Oh, we should do that. We could do like we could do it for Earth Day.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, we should do that. But for now, I think we can agree.
And here's where I do want to say though, I hear your scientific consensus argument, and I respond with a look. We're not saying that it's just a matter of the Earth is warming and there's a consensus that human activity could be a part of it. Because to me, again, that's not scientific. Scientific is saying we can measure this and we can tell you this is what it's doing and this is what the outcome will be. And if you do X, you will get a result of Y.
Oh, I totally disagree with that. I mean, I think
if we launch this rocket at this speed and we're judging the motion of these bodies and correctly, we can land the rocket on the comet. And that's science. We know what we're doing, and you know what? The proof that we got it right is that we landed the spaceship on the comet.
I would disagree. I think when you're dealing with enormously complex systems like the global climate, that you can't be that precise, and expecting that level of precision is just wrong. But what we can say is we can talk in generalities
on moons of Saturn. That's pretty complicated. That's pretty precise.
Well, yeah, but I mean, talking about making predictions about what's going to happen in 10, 20, 30 years, that's when you're right. That's when things get a lot less precise because we don't really know. And what the media, unfortunately, tends to do is they tend to focus on the worst-case scenario in a range of estimates. And I think that is a problem. But on the other hand, the potential disaster, if the worst-case scenario happens, is something that needs to be considered because this is the only planet that we have, of course. But again, we're getting into territory that I think we could go on
right.
for.
So bottom line, you think is the global warming, is it a belief or is it simply a scientific fact that you accept?
Global warming is a scientific fact
change,
that I have accepted. Yeah, that climate change is a scientific fact that I accept, just like the vast, vast majority of all climate scientists.
All right. Well, I will go on record again as saying I love science, and it's precisely because I love science that I'm skeptical over precise conclusions. And if we can start seeing the models that are variously put together actually predicting actual outcomes that actually work, then I'm happy to sign on with you, but I haven't seen that yet. So
okay, well, we'll definitely have to have a longer and I'm sure fairly contentious debate on this. Like you said, maybe for an Earth Day episode, that would be great.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. I don't know if you heard about this. The Secret Service is in the news again. This week, this last week, two senior Secret Service agents were under investigation for crashing a government-issued car into a White House barricade after a night of drinking.
I like how you say that they're under investigation for crashing a white like they see that the car kind of crumpled up against the barricades,
right?
The truck and officer stumbling out and wonder what's going on here. Let's an investigation,
yeah.
But
and these aren't new guys. One of these guys, in fact, was the second in command on Obama's personal protective detail.
Yes.
So, I love the quote from the chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, who has, you know, oversight authority over the Secret Service. He said, "It's never good to be drunk at work, especially if you are in the Secret Service."
I think that's hard to argue
with. Of course, the Secret Service has had a rough time lately. In 2012, there were
Some good times in South America.
There were a dozen of them. Yeah,
the service had a rough time. Individual agents have had quite a good time. So,
There were, like I said, in 2012, a dozen of them were caught with prostitutes in Colombia, and they had been drinking. And I love the report I read. Nearly all of those agents were dismissed.
Right.
So, you know, there were a few, they were with the hookers, and they weren't drinking that much, I guess, or I don't know exactly how that works. And then, of course, last year, there were two agents that were sent home from a presidential trip to Europe. One of them was found passed out in a hotel hallway from a night of drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of there's
also been various lapses in security. For example, the president's trip to South Africa, where there was the sort of goofy would-be sign language interpreter at Nelson Mandela's funeral.
Right.
President sharing an elevator ride with other folks who had not been cleared.
Last fall, the guy climbed over the White House fence, and apparently the Secret Service, they were off drinking. He got all the way inside. And I think the guy who actually tackled him was an off-duty agent who was apparently just coming to or going from a bar or something like that. I don't know. But the Secret Service has a problem. It seems like it has a drinking problem. You feel like you could have a really good 12-step meeting with just Secret Service agents, I think. So what do you think's going on with the Secret Service?
Well, there's obviously been some sort of managerial problems, and you know, the administration vowed to get to the bottom of this a couple years ago after the Colombian situation, and it appears it still hasn't happened. So it looks like it just must be some sort of, you know, you hate to say cultural ingrained, but I mean, obviously that's got to be one of the highest stress jobs in the world.
And, of course, a great way to deal with stress is to get drunk. Yeah.
To drive your car drunk into your place of work.
Yeah. It's certainly not. Well, and, you know, you might wonder what we can do about this. I would say perhaps testing of agents to make sure they're actually not they're not drinking or not drunk on duty. I don't know. It seems like a reasonable idea. If, you know, Republicans want to drug test or want to test, potential benefits recipients, maybe we should do some drug testing on Secret Service agents.
Well, I should absolutely. And I would hope that we already do or did. But
I think it needs to be maybe a little more frequent if they're crashing in the barricades and passing out drunk in hallways. I don't know if it's that unreasonable to say that if you're a Secret Service agent and you are on call or potentially could be on call, that you can't have any alcohol.
Yeah, well, I'd be on board with that.
So,
you know, call me a killjoy here the weekend before St. Patrick's Day, but yes.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a reasonable thing. But it seems like the Secret Service is a good place to go if you want to have fun. I don't know, a good time. It seems to be had by all. It's all fun and games until someone crashes into a White House barricade.
Yep.
I guess. So,
hey, I actually, you know, I want to throw out one last thing as we're getting ready to go. And this is, again, goes to the Logan Act and the Vox article, the letter and some of the responses that were out there. And I'm going to observe that, you know, it's been said that all procedural arguments are disingenuous. And I think we could add to that a lot of arguments about diplomatic protocol are likewise disingenuous. You know, Joe Biden made the statements that this was an unprecedented act, this open letter. But you do just a little bit of research, and apparently no one thought to fact check Joe Biden, which, I mean, let that sentence sit in for a minute. But you can do just a little bit of research and find numerous, numerous other occasions where sitting members of Congress have engaged in discussions with foreign governments against the will of the administration. And this is what some might say is using the argumentative fallacy of tu quoque, meaning, well, you did it too, so it's kind of two wrongs make a right. But when someone's saying that the reason this is shocking and terrible because it's unprecedented, I think it is fair argumentation to say, no, it's not unprecedented. And my examples would be there was a letter written by a bunch of senators. I believe Senator Biden was included in this to Sandinista Comandante Daniel Ortega. This was back in the 1980s. And it's called the Dear Comandante letter. fact that if you're starting a letter saying "Dear Comandante," just nothing good's going to come of it.
Well, I want to point out though, the big difference is that was 10 representatives that wrote this letter, whereas in this there was 47, almost all but seven Republican senators. So that is a big difference, and I think maybe it's more reflective of how politics has changed since the 1980s. It's much more partisan, much more divided, and so forth. So, okay, I'll grant your point. Absolutely, this is not unprecedented.
Well,
but...
no, and I'm saying, in fairness to my other thing, saying it's all disingenuous, Newt Gingrich was outraged by this and suggested it may have been, in fact, been a violation of the Logan Act.
You love the Logan Act.
I do love the Logan Act. I'm a big scholar of that, like early Federalist period. So yeah, I do. But another example, that, which is even a little more sinister, is that there's evidence that Ted Kennedy in 1984 met with the Soviets in order, and the deal was, listen, hey Andropov, I will give you some hints on how to deal with Reagan, on how to respond to these things. In return, I would appreciate some support from the Soviet Union in my election campaign or planning on running for president.
Wow.
And at first I thought, you know, when I first ran across the story, I thought this is sort of something out of the fever swamps of the right. But no, I've looked this up and there's a lot of credible sources for it. I'll go ahead and post the link. I mean, the most recent one was from Forbes. But even if you set that aside, you've got the Nancy Pelosi going to meet with Bashar al-Assad. You've got Congressman Jim McDermott, who is going to be a human shield in Baghdad. It happens all the time, and you can say that it may be ill-advised, but it's not unprecedented, and it's not a shocking violation of the separation of powers.
I disagree with you, and we'll have to end on this disagreement, but I disagree with you because I think it's not unprecedented in the sense that it hasn't ever been done before. You might say that's the definition of unprecedented. Fair enough.
Yes, it is, in fact.
But what is unprecedented is the almost unified response of one party. It's one thing to have Ted Kennedy doing some insane thing. It's a whole other thing for almost all of the Senate Republicans to be doing it. To me, that is unprecedented.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, and I might even have some other examples that we can post to the website on massive actions by sitting senators. But I think that's it for this week.
Yeah, that is for this week's episode. That's all. Thank you for listening. If you have any thoughts, comments, criticisms, we'd love to hear from you. Our email is politicsguys@gmail.com. That's politicsguys, one word, @gmail.com. We'll be back next Sunday with another look at the week in American politics. We hope you'll join us.